Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Michael Reed Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Tuesday morning, the 16th of April. Good morning. With much debate and discussion from now till 11 a.m, this is Michael Reid on LMFM. Ireland's third national cancer strategy was launched by Simon Harris, who was the Minister for Health in 2017. The Irish Cancer Society says it was proud to sit on the steering committee that developed that strategy, and it says it expected the strategy would lead to significant improvements in cancer outcomes. Last week, however, the Irish Cancer Society highlighted how the strategy is falling down. This, they say, is because of a lack of government funding. The improvements in cancer outcomes that it had expected from the implementation of the National Cancer Strategy are now no longer expected.
And in some areas, things have significantly disimproved since 2017. Waiting times for radiotherapy have increased, with expensive equipment lying idle in several hospitals at the moment due to an ongoing shortage of radiation therapists. And inequality between public and private patients is growing, particularly in terms of access to new medicines.
The Irish Cancer Society is asking what the point is of having a plan if that plan cannot be implemented because the money necessary to do that is simply not available.
Inadequate government funding and the impact of COVID-19 on cancer diagnosis and treatment means we are no longer confident that that will be the case. In fact, we are concerned that Ireland's cancer outcomes may have stagnated or even disimproved since the strategy was published.
The Irish Cancer Society says that with cancer rates expected to double by 2045, one in two of us will be diagnosed with cancer. And it is those people, half of us, who will be diagnosed as having cancer who will suffer.
Without proper funding, the National Cancer Strategy is a plan without action. And a plan without action is not a plan, it is just words. And words are no comfort to someone languishing on a waiting list for a cancer test, getting more and more worried by the day. Or to the healthcare professional trying to do their best in a chaotic system, knowing their patients are not getting the standard of care they deserve.
So what about the funding for this strategy? Well, in the 7 years since the publication of the National Cancer Strategy, money for developing the strategy has been made available. The Irish Cancer Society says in just two out of the seven budgets since 2017.
The National Cancer Control Programme has only been given proper funding for the current National Cancer Strategy in two of the seven budgets since it was published, 2021 and 2022.
That's Avril Doyle of the Irish Cancer Society speaking before the Oireachtas Health Committee last week. And if what the Irish Cancer Society is saying isn't enough to cause anger or anxiety, well, let's listen to what 20 of the country's leading cancer doctors and researchers are saying about the situation. In an open letter to an Taoiseach, Simon Harris, which is published in the Irish Examiner today, which they say is an effort to highlight the impact that the lack of investment in the strategy is having on people with cancer in this country. Screening has not been expanded as planned. Target waiting times for cancer tests are not being met. Cancer surgeries are free frequently delayed due to shortages in staffing beds and theatre space. Investment in infrastructure has been lacking despite increasing infection control issues and rising cancer incidence. Radiotherapy services are operating significantly below capacity. We are falling far short of the already modest target of 6% of cancer patients participating in clinical trials. Ireland is also one of the slowest countries in Western Europe to make new medicines available to public patients. And the 20 doctors and researchers who are all leading in their fields in cancer treatment and research, they say they have no reason to believe that the situation in this country has improved. Rather, they say, given the pressure on services, Ireland's cancer outcomes are at risk of going backwards. Let's speak to Sinn Féin's spokesperson on health, David Cullinan, who's on the line. And a very good morning to you, David Cullinan, and thank you for joining us. Tell us about your private member's motion that you're putting before the Dáil this evening.
Well, first of all, I think you've set out very clearly all of the problems and challenges that we have, Michael. So last week when the Irish Cancer Society was before the Oireachtas Health Committee, I had met them a number of times leading up to their appearance. In fact, I had supported them in having an opportunity to come before the Oireachtas Health Committee. And it was very stark, the warning that they gave, that they said they have no confidence at this point in time due to a lack of funding, that improvements in cancer outcomes will continue to improve over the next number of years. So as the Irish Cancer Society pointed out, in five of the last 7 years, the National Cancer Strategy was not properly funded. Three of those years, of course, Simon Harris was Minister for Health and the rest, Stephen Dunley was Minister for Health. The National Cancer Control Programme is the programme that is funded by the HSE and reports to the HSE that requests the funding for the cancer strategy. And bear in mind, the purpose of having a national strategy is that you plan for the health needs of the population in that area, that you work with stakeholders, you liaise with the HSE, with the Department of Health, you liaise with the hospitals right across the state, all of the cancer services, and you determine what additional investments are needed to ensure that we can continue to improve services and ensure that cancer services are to the strength that they should be. And I put the question to the head of the National Cancer Control Programme at the same Oireachtas Health Committee. How much money did you ask for last year for the budget for 2024, and how much did you receive? They asked for €20 million. They received zero in funding, in additional funding. And as we know, in five of the 7 years, the proper funding was not given. So if the cancer strategy has not got the funding, it means it can't hire the staff, it can't expand services. We have pressures right across the system. You mentioned the open letter from 20 healthcare professionals, including very senior doctors.
Including Professor John Kennedy, who you mentioned a moment ago, who is the chair of the National Cancer Strategy Steering Group.
Exactly, and these are people who are at the heart of this issue, who are trying to deliver the services that people need. And they've been pointing out to us for a long time that we have expensive life-saving equipment, whether it's radiotherapy equipment, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, diagnostics, across a whole range of hospitals in Cork, in Galway, in Dublin and elsewhere, where the equipment is not being properly used because of staffing shortages. And that is an outrageous opportunity that's lost at the moment, because we don't have that equipment providing the life-saving surgeries and the life-saving treatments that people need. And that again is a consequence of not funding the strategy, not hiring the staff which is needed. And as I said, in five of the 7 years, it's not good enough that we have a government and two ministers for health in Simon Harris and Stephen Donnelly who have not given the National Cancer Strategy the funding that it needs. And we now have alarm bells being sounded by the Irish Cancer Society on the one hand, but more importantly, I would argue, the people who are the clinicians and the experts in this area at the centre of delivering the strategy, again, sounding alarm bells and saying that the investments are not being made and cancer outcomes will not improve because of it.
Some of the most eminent people working on researching cancer and treating cancer have put their names to this letter, and they say that people with cancer in Ireland deserve the best possible chance of surviving the disease and enjoying a good quality of life afterwards. But this will only be achieved through properly resourced cancer services with protected pathways that are not disrupted by other pressures on the health service. I know people are very reluctant and understandably hesitant in stating the impact of this, but I think it has been said by the Irish Cancer Society now that people will die unnecessarily prematurely as a result of the strategy, the National Cancer Strategy, that is, not being funded.
Well, I think it's not good enough in the first instance, Michael, that we have a national strategy where the ownership of that strategy lies actually with the Minister for Health. This is not a HSE strategy or a Department of Health strategy. I asked, who is the one person who is responsible for the National Cancer Strategy at the Oireachtas Health Committee? And the response from the HSE was, it's the Minister for Health. It's policy that drives then the National Cancer Strategy. The resources that come to support the strategy obviously come from budgets and come from the Minister. So we've had two Ministers for Health who between them have not properly funded the strategy. As I said, we have equipment which is lying idle. We don't have the staff to provide the services that people need. So the first thing the Minister needs to do is to ensure that the €20 million that was sought for 2024 is given. It makes no sense when you have a budget of €24 billion in healthcare. And I know that the Minister said a plan out yesterday now to achieve savings in healthcare and efficiencies. But we also need to make sure that we are providing the healthcare services that people need, because the most important responsibility of the Minister for Health is to ensure that the health service is capable of improving health outcomes, of providing the range of treatments that patients need. We know one of the biggest killers, of course, is cancer in this state. One in two people will contract cancer or develop cancer, unfortunately. We have to make sure that people have the best health opportunities. We know that when patients get into the system in any of our cancer services, they get excellent treatment. So none of the criticism of lack of investment and poor health outcomes is in any way a slight on the staff who are doing fantastic work. Anybody listening to the programme who's been through any of our cancer programmes, cancer services, will tell you that they get excellent treatment. But we have to make sure that every patient has the opportunity, Michael. So the first port of call here, the first ask in our budget is for the Minister to fund the strategy for 2024. We also, and I've been saying this for some time, need a proper workforce planning strategy. And essentially what that means is that you are looking at population growth, health demand, and you determine from that what healthcare professionals do we need across a range of specialties. So we know that radiation therapists are hard to recruit. We're not training enough of them. We see it with radiographers as well in hospitals. And I've been saying for a long, long number of years that we have to increase training places quite dramatically right across the health service. There are some areas where we have sufficient flow of graduates coming through, and there are some areas where we don't, and it's hurting the healthcare system. And again, I just have to point this out. The minister with responsibility for this for the last 4 years was Simon Harris. Hmm. He was the Minister for Higher Education. And again, I had been asking that he and Stephen Donnelly would work in tandem to make sure that we have sufficient numbers of graduates who are training so that we can recruit the specialists into this area. And again, our motion calls for a proper workforce plan for sufficient training of all of these specialties, because we can't have a situation where we're spending huge amounts of money on very expensive equipment, which obviously needs to be fully utilised. But then we find out from experts, from clinicians and from the Irish Cancer Society, that a lot of this expensive life-saving equipment is actually lying idle.
Yeah, and that's also highlighted in this letter from these academics and doctors, the experts in cancer in the Irish Examiner today. And as you say, people who've had cancer will tell you about the excellent care that they've received from the Irish Health Service. But those experts in their letter say it is simply not possible to provide optimal care or patient outcomes under the conditions that staff are working under, despite their best efforts. And they also say that Ireland has the third highest cancer mortality rate in Western Europe, according to the European Cancer Inequalities Register.
And we also learn from the same medics, from the same consultants, from the same specialists, but also from the Irish Cancer Society, that a large number of cancer appointments were cancelled last year. Why were they cancelled? Because of overcrowding in hospitals. And again, I've been pointing out that the government seems to think that one of the solutions to people on hospital trolleys and overcrowding is to move the problem and shift it from one part of the health service to the other by cancelling planned and elective surgeries and hospital appointments and procedures. All of that obviously has consequences for patients, where patients are waiting longer. And we heard again from a leading medic last week, who was on the front page of the Irish Independent, that many cancer appointments and many cancer surgeries were cancelled because of overcrowding in hospitals. I heard yesterday the plan from the Minister for Health to try and achieve efficiencies in healthcare. The best way to achieve efficiencies and to reduce spend in healthcare, to eliminate wasteful spend, is not to increase funding in agency staff, in outsourcing, in management consultancy, which this government has done, but actually to make sure that people are getting the right care in the right place at the right time. If we had proper step-down recovery convalescent beds, we could discharge more patients safely. One of the issues which was in the report yesterday, Michael, that was published, the external report that was published by the Minister that looked at spend in healthcare, was that people stay in hospitals is longer. Why is it longer? Because people can't access home care, they can't get step-down recovery beds in the community, which means people stay longer in hospitals. It's more expensive, but it also leads to hospital overcrowding. And hospital overcrowding leads to more cancellations, which includes time-sensitive operations and procedures as well. So all of these are problems which the Minister needs to grapple with. But the seriousness of the cancer strategy cannot be understated, because it does come back to a lack of funding from two ministers that held the portfolio, one currently Stephen Donnelly and Simon Harris when he was Minister for Health. And of course, these are questions that we will put to Simon Harris over the next number of days and weeks, the new Taoiseach of the country.
Indeed, your motion this evening will ask the government to put money into funding that strategy, as I suppose everybody had expected would have happened since 2017, but it has only happened on 2 out of the 7 years. David, we leave it there for the moment. Thank you indeed for joining us on the programme today. David Cullinan is Sinn Féin's spokesperson on health. Our phone number is 0419832000. Text or WhatsApp 0861800658. Email michael@lmfm.ie.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Nursing Homes Ireland is launching its strategic plan up to 2026 today. They say they've spent much time listening to residents, members and other stakeholders to develop a strategy which Nursing Homes Ireland says is brought to life by the word homes. Homes. H for highlighting the voices of residents and members. O for organising campaigns to have their voices heard. M for motivating the government and society at large. E for engaging our residents and members. And S for shaping the provision of care for our ageing population. That is the acronym HOMES. Let's speak to Tadhg Daly, Chief Executive Officer of Nursing Homes Ireland. A very good morning to you, Tadhg, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. There's a problem with funding, I take it.
Yeah, good morning, Michael. Man, good to speak with you. Well, ultimately, I suppose what we're trying to do today, a strategy isn't the most exciting element of anyone's plans, but you clearly need to have a strategic plan to achieve your goals. And as you outlined there, it's a very exciting strategy brought to life by the word homes. So it is funding to a degree, but it's also about the plan for an ageing population. You've heard me say on many an occasion that we should be celebrating the fact that people are living longer and plan accordingly. So it's around funding, it's around workforce, it's around future capacity, and it's about integration of the sector into the wider health service. Mm. And a plan for both short, medium, and indeed longer term.
Okay. And as a result of underfunding, we've seen nursing homes close, 71 homes altogether nationally.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's been a very, very difficult period over the last number of years with significant increase in costs, hyperinflation, and the funding mechanism not keeping pace with that. So that's forced over 71 homes closing. But when you look at that number, what we're really looking at here is over 2,500 older people had to move from what is their home. And that's the real tragedy, the real heartbreak. And for many of those homes that are in rural and indeed urban Ireland, they won't reopen again. So there's a loss of the home to that individual who lived there, but there's also a loss of those services in the community, with the impact on choice, with the impact on availability of a nursing home bed in their local area, and a huge impact back on the acute hospital system. So, you know, this is an issue that isn't going to improve unless we take decisive action.
Okay, I don't think anybody likes to see a loved one going into a nursing home, but I think it's only people who have had a relative in such a situation who understand what the impact might be on people in nursing homes being told that they have to get up and leave and then accustomise themselves to a whole new set of circumstances, a whole new setting for that matter.
Absolutely, and that's the real issue, you know, that's the real heartbreaking human story behind all of those closures. And as you say, you know, making the decision in the first case to require nursing home care because the person can no longer be cared for at home is very difficult. So getting used to the new surroundings for the individual and indeed for their family and friends coming to visit is challenging. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But then to be told that the nursing home is closing, you know, that causes untold heartbreak for all concerned. So we need to avoid that at all costs and take whatever steps we can to ensure that. And to be fair, government have marginally increased funding over the last while, but there needs to be a more fundamental look at how we fund nursing home care. And as I say, celebrate aging. And it's not just about nursing homes. It's about daycare, it's about home care, it's about Meals on Wheels, independent living and nursing home care. So there's a full continuum of services for older people to ensure that they can receive the best possible standard of care. And we're very encouraged. You know, HICWA recently undertook the National Resident Experience Survey, and over 90.3% of people had a good or a very good experience. So the care is of a very high standard, and that's down to the staff. And those staff need to be recognised and remunerated for the hard work that they do. So there's a number of issues there to address, and we want to work collaboratively with government to address those. New Taoiseach Minister, now Taoiseach Harris, was a Minister for Health, so he has a good grasp of the sector, dealt with us very well throughout the COVID period. So we'll be engaging with the new Taoiseach and indeed ministers and indeed local election candidates over the next while so that we can, bring that strategy to life and communicate what the key issues are so that decisive action can be taken.
Okay, but where is the solution in all of this? If it's not viable for some nursing homes to stay open, is it simply a matter of increasing the cost to patients? Because nursing home care is very expensive, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, care in whatever setting is expensive. Care in an acute hospital is of the order of €8,000 per week. You know, €1,000 per day. Nursing home care in the public system is about €2,000 a week, and the average in the private sector is running now at about €1,100 a week. So it is costly, but I mean, ultimately, you know, we've got to put a value on the care that is provided. So it is about more funding. But it is about a vision and a plan, an ambitious plan for the ageing of our population. So, because if I'm a nursing home owner currently and I don't see anything happening by way of funding or indeed strategy or policy, I don't see things changing any day soon, then it hastens the closure of a home. Whereas, yeah, funding is important, don't get me wrong, and resourcing. But if people felt that things were going to change, then hopefully we'd stabilise the sector. And that's a priority now, is to stabilise existing provision to ensure that we don't lose any more. And it is going to cost more, but a society we've got to make those decisions.
Well, what way would you decide if the decision was in your gift? Where should this extra money come from? Should it come from Exchequer funding, or should it result in a higher charge for the residents?
I think it's a combination of both, to be honest with you, Michael. I mean, ultimately, the Fair Deal scheme is a very good scheme, and that is government policy. So what government have looked at over a number of years is a review of the pricing mechanism. And all three reviews have said the very same thing, that the pricing mechanism, is not fit for purpose. So that's what needs to be looked at in terms of how are we going to, as a society, fund older persons' care into the future. You're seeing significant, additional funding in childcare, for example. You know, they would argue that it's not sufficient, but that's a decision that government have made. What's happening here is that, you know, the risks associated with not taking action are going to be much, much greater. And, you know, that's a political decision. That's a political decision, ultimately. And, you know, family...
Well, it's a societal decision, isn't it? I mean, we were talking about cancer care a few moments ago. And if you're lucky enough not to get cancer, obviously you don't have the costs that are incurred by cancer patients. And the same applies to all these things. When it comes to nursing home residents, what it means is a smaller inheritance for their children. And people don't like that because we're talking about people's legacies here. And that's kind of because they were unfortunate in life to end up needing nursing home care, because most people won't need that.
Well, and that's what the Fair Deal is trying to do, is to ensure that people won't have to wind down all of their assets. Because at the moment, under Fair Deal, a person contributes 80% of their income and up to 22.5% of their house. That was increased from 15%. And that may need to be increased again, because I think, to be fair, if people are getting a good standard of care and a good service, they don't mind contributing to it. But it needs to be transparent, it needs to be visible, and people need to have certainty. Because that's the issue historically prior to Fair Deal, was that people could maybe sell their house, end up with maybe a couple of hundred thousand, but that could be run down very quickly. So certainty is the key issue here. And I think that's the point about shaping the provision of care for older people. We need, as a society, as I said, to have a full and frank discussion. There is no national conversation about care of the older person. And in our mind, that's where the motivating comes into as part of our homes, is motivating government, political leaders, society and society at large to have a conversation about what the future of nursing home care is going to look like. What type of care do we want? Do we need more independent living, more home care? But there's always going to be a requirement for nursing home care. And then how are we going to fund that so that we give certainty to families, certainty to staff who work in the sector, and to those who are investing to provide the care?
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Thank you, as always, for joining us this morning. Tyne Daly, CEO of Nursing Homes Ireland.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Well, if you were watching Primetime last night, I'm sure you were taken aback by some of the counselling given to women in crisis pregnancies. Let's speak to Aoife Hegarty of RTE Investigates. A very good morning to you, Aoife, and thank you indeed for joining us to tell us a bit about your investigation that you conducted over a period of 7 months. Maybe you take us to the Strand Road in Derry to begin with and tell us a little bit about what you discovered there for listeners who may not have seen your programme last night.
Well, morning. Last night's investigation, I suppose, all centred around a government commissioned report, which was published last April. And it was that report, I guess, was sanctioned as part of abortion legislation that came in 2019. And it said that 3 years later, a review of that law should take place. Now, that review makes a number of recommendations, and one of those related to a recommendation that the Department of Health should introduce quality assurance measures across the pregnancy counselling sector to safeguard women from what Barrister Marie O'Shea referred to as rogue counselling services. Now, as part of our research, several times the name of a particular agency came up, and that was the Advocate Women's Centre, which is located on Strand Road in Derry City. And it was one of a number of places listeners would have seen we attended last night. We had a researcher go there posing as a 27-year-old childminder living in Letterkenny in Donegal. And while that centre to the outward eye portrays a very impartial look, its website offers to provide information on all options so that women can make an informed decision. There are many Google search ads also have that impartial look, including an offer to provide information on the abortion pill. But when we went there, we met an approach that was in stark contrast to that.
A spiritual sweet shop, by all accounts.
Yeah, so we were first introduced to a middle-aged woman who described herself as an advocate. That woman encouraged our researcher to slow down and consider her options, which I guess in a crisis pregnancy situation would be entirely sensible. But before long, the centre's very neutral outward look, you know, a contrast began to appear, and that included, as you say, referring to the advocate referring to her spiritual sweet shop, where she encouraged our researcher to pray scriptures for God, so that it would encourage a change to her situation. And she then went from there to meeting the centre's in-house nurse, and that nurse engaged in some very questionable approaches, including talking about the potential risks that they believe are associated with having an abortion, including that if she were to have a surgical abortion, that she was at risk of having preterm births in future pregnancies. And as you would have heard, various experts who we interviewed last night, they questioned the basis for those claims.
Falsehoods.
Well, in their opinion, like, for instance, the nurse would have told our researcher that if she had a surgical abortion, that because they have, in her words, to force the cervix open to get instruments in, that would, just like an elastic band, cause the cervix to lose its elasticity. And as you would have heard a consultant gynaecologist in the programme last night, he referred to that as absolutely extraordinary, saying that type of advice is just designed to frighten and has no place in modern healthcare practice.
Right, and this centre is of particular interest, I think, to our listeners locally, because after the prayers in the spiritual sweet shop where false information was given about the after effects of having an abortion, you've reported that the Advocate Women's Centre is planning to open it in Drogheda next month.
Well, the Advocate Women's Centre has plans to expand. It's owned by Human Life International Ireland, which is the Irish branch of an American pro-life organisation, and it's headquartered in Knock in County Mayo. But as part of our research, yeah, we did learn that it plans to open a new centre in Drogheda, County Louth, by next month.
Are these advice centres, these counselling centres, regulated in any way?
No, and that is one of the major recommendations from Marie O'Shea's review. She says in order to mitigate against the risk of women encountering misinformation which may delay or preclude access to termination of pregnancy services, she says that the Department of Health must introduce quality assurance measures to safeguard women. Now, for its part, we did write to Human Life International Ireland in relation to our findings. And they said that they believe their information services fulfil a need which are not reflected in the current facilities available to pregnant women, and it will continue to do so. But as you say, this is a sector that remains entirely unregulated.
It wasn't the only counselling service that your researchers visited. Tell us about carrying rocks around.
So we learned about this organisation called Rachel's Vineyard through one of the counselling services which provide counselling to women who have an unplanned pregnancy. But on its website, under post-abortion care, it also said it provides referrals and fundings to retreats with this American-founded organisation called Rachel's Vineyard. It was set up in Ireland in 2003. It's a registered charity. It promotes itself as therapy for the soul, and it holds these weekend retreats for people to heal from what it says are the after effects of abortion. Now, the retreats take place at private locations around the country, including County Cork, and that's where we had a number of researchers attend for 2 out of the 3 days. And there, I guess, we encountered a number of strange therapies that there was no indication we would encounter prior to going there.
Okay, including carrying stones or rocks around all of the time.
Yeah, so this they encourage participants to carry this rock as a symbol of what they say is their post-abortion burden. And women were told to carry these rocks, as you say, at all times, including to places like the dining room, to bed, to the shower. And that was, they said, because they needed to even sleep with it, because in their words, the pain never leaves you. So again, we would have had experts review that footage, and listeners would have heard them last night to talk about the dangers of those kind of things, and how people who attend these retreats could potentially be the most vulnerable and susceptible, and that as a result could fuel insecurities or vulnerabilities that they have.
Okay, we must be mindful, of course, Aoife, that there could very well be somebody listening to us who is experiencing a crisis pregnancy as we speak, and they want to get expert advice. They want the best advice possible. Where should they go to avoid these voodoo clinics, if you like?
Yeah, well, the My Options helpline run by the HSE, it's a free phone helpline, and it provides non-judgmental and confidential information and counselling for people experiencing an unplanned pregnancy. And that is the first port of call for anyone in that situation.
Very good. Eye-opening television last night. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Aoife Hegarty, RTE Investigates reporter. Now, let me bring you some of the comments. Actually, we'll do that after the headlines. In the meantime, let me just tell you how to get in touch if you'd like to. 0419832000 if you want to ring, text or WhatsApp 0861800658. Email michael@lmfm.ie.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
The Irish Heart Foundation is looking for additional funding so that it can help people after a heart heart attack or stroke to live at home, and the Irish Heart Foundation is asking you to help them with this appeal for additional funding. Chris Macy, Director of Advocacy and Patient Support with the Irish Heart Foundation, is on the line. Good morning to you, Chris. Thanks for joining us on the programme this morning. You're dreadfully underfunded, it would seem, and you're asking people to get on to their local politicians about this.
Yeah, this isn't a call for funding from the public. It's a call for the public to get the state to start supporting our services. There's 80,000 heart and stroke patients being discharged from hospital in Ireland every year. That's one every 7 minutes. And the vast majority of those are returning home with no help, really, to navigate the huge everyday challenges that they inevitably face. And so the Heart Foundation is filling this void really with a pathway of practical, social and emotional services the patients themselves describe as a lifeline. So now around one in three of all stroke patients nationally who are returning home are referred into our services, and we're also supporting thousands of heart patients. It's 7,000 people we're supporting every year, but against a background of 600,000 people living with cardiovascular disease, that's a drop in the ocean, really. So, even though that's so small, less than 10% of our services are funded by the state. And, even though they're endorsed by the HSE and certainly in the CHO covering Loud, we don't receive any funding at all. And we're providing very significant services both on the ground and by phone, online, etc.
Because people are living at home, but you're receiving just 8.6% of what you need nationally.
That's right. Yeah. So in Louth, we've two support groups at the moment. One in the Dundalk Sports Complex. In, not sure if I can pronounce this properly. We're Heaven Amore.
Perfect.
Yeah, and then in Drogheda, we were in the D Hotel, and we're searching obviously for an alternative to that now. In Meath, also we've a heart failure support group that runs out of Ashbourne Library, and then we're supporting huge numbers through a pathway of services that starts with a nurse-led assessment, goes into short programs that meet specific needs around things like fatigue management for stroke and vocational services, cognitive skills supports, and many more.
Invaluable
groups
Service that you deliver relatively cheaply. It's just over a million euro. But if you're receiving 10% or less than 10% of what you need, where is the rest of the money coming from? You started off by saying you're not appealing to the public, but is it the public who's making donations to fund your service as things stand?
Obviously, we're always looking for donations, and I'm not saying for people not to do that. It's just that, to put this on a sort of a long-term service on a long-term footing, you know, we need statutory support. So at the moment, you know, it's we're getting around 100,000 euros out of between 1.25 and 1.5 million that we're spending. So we're depleting our reserves to do that.
And without the goodwill of people, without the charitable donations that you receive from people, what would happen otherwise? Where would people go if they couldn't live independently at home?
There's nothing. You know, there are some other charities. There are some pockets of you know, of good services around the country, but that, you know, they're sort of clinical services that the HC provides, but we're not trying to replicate those. What we're trying to do is meet the practical, social and emotional needs of people. Now, I'll give you one example, though. In terms of clinical psychology, I think 1 in 5 stroke units across the country has any clinical psychology for stroke patients. And I think there's only 3 hospitals in the country, say, for heart failure patients. These are conditions that lead to post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, and in large numbers of cases. In stroke, we had a survey recently that showed 1 in 8 people who have a stroke have suicidal ideation. And there's no psychological supports for people in large parts of the country, except for the counselling services that we provide through the support of the good people of Ireland, the fivers and tenors of the good people of Ireland, keeping that going. And, you know, that's no way to deliver, you know, long-term professional services to people who really need help. You know, we need the state to step in to make these sustainable. Now, I have to say, we've gone and we've been listened to at a high level in the HSE. You know, they've listened to our case, but because of the funding issues they have, you know, we haven't been successful to date. We're keeping that conversation going. But this is a national sort of level funding that we need to address here.
Yeah, I'm sure
it needs to be addressed at that level by the HSE.
I'm sure there's a lot of people listening who, like me, can't understand why a vital service like this isn't being funded. It's the type of thing that could happen to anybody, you, me, or our loved ones at any age, it seems. In fact, you're citing the example of a 33-year-old woman from Dundalk, Carmel Finnegan, who ended up availing of your services after just giving birth to her second child, I think it was.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, in Carmel's case, you know, it's unfortunately, it's becoming more and more regular that people in younger age groups are you know, suffering these sort of events. And, you know, it's just not being addressed. I think in the younger age groups, particularly, can you imagine having a stroke or a diagnosis of a serious life-limiting heart disease? You know, in your 30s or 40s, with a young family to support, not knowing if you.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Be able to return to work and not having any help to do that. Mm. That's just not, it's not fair and it's not right. And the state has to step up and start, you know, supporting people in this area. This is the biggest, you know, cardiovascular disease is the biggest, along with cancer, is the biggest cause of death we have. 30% of all deaths, are down to heart disease and stroke. And yet, you know, people are not being, not getting any realistic services in the community, apart from small pockets, unless they can afford to pay for them themselves. And, you know, it's just not fair on those people and their families as well, who have to deal with this, it alone, apart from the few that, you know, that we can get to, and we need to be able to get to many more.
Okay. And you're asking public representatives, they don't need to be lobbied by members of the public. You're asking them directly to sign a pledge. If their names don't appear on your website, you're asking the public to get in touch with their local TDs or senators and ask them to sign the pledge.
Yeah, exactly. We're coming into a year of elections. A large proportion of the population is affected by cardiovascular disease. You know, 600,000 people plus their families and friends. You know, I suppose what we're asking them to do is to try and impress upon politicians how important this area is, and hopefully how strongly people feel about it. And, you know, and when they go to decide who they want to vote for in the elections, among all the considerations that they have in making their decision, that they factor in, you know, who is among our politicians, who is showing support in this area, and who's interested in making things better for heart and stroke patients around the country.
All right. Well, they are vital services. I think a lot of people will testify to that. You had a very interesting statistic that every 7 minutes, one person is discharged from hospital after a heart attack or having had a stroke. Any medic, I take it, Chris, you'd argue that prevention is better than cure, and while we all may end up with heart problems or having a stroke, far better to take the steps to prevent it from happening. And I see you're one of a number of people who's signed a letter in the papers today to raise the legal age of sale of tobacco in this country to 21. The Tobacco 21 Alliance is the banner under which you're making this appeal to the government.
That's correct, Michael. This was done in America, actually, an order was signed by Donald Trump while he was the president in 2019. To increase the legal age of sale of tobacco in the United States on a federal basis to 21. It's had a hugely positive impact. We're talking about, you know, 4,500 deaths every year from tobacco in this country. The crucial ages are in that 18 to 20 year where people, young people become addicted to smoking. And if we can stop that, we can have a huge benefit. I think on the extrapolation of people aged, just being born now to being aged 20, I think in Ireland the extrapolation on this is if we introduce this law now, it would lead to 3,500 lives in that age group being saved over time. And what better reason than that do you need? I mean, we've got to start getting real about smoking. They're phasing out the sale of tobacco in the UK, and we're going to have a situation quite soon where in Northern Ireland, children of a certain age, as they get older, will never legally be able to buy cigarettes, and we have a different regime down here. So the minister has said he's supporting it, and we're really delighted about that. And we will want to give every support now to the Department of Health, the minister, and the government to get this this regulation over the line as quickly as possible.
Very good. We leave there. Thank you very much, Chris, for joining us on the programme this morning. Chris Macy is Director of Advocacy and Patient Support with the Irish Heart Foundation. Now, WhatsApp message from somebody who tells us about a meeting that is planned for the 21st of April in Dundalk. That would be Sunday coming, wouldn't it? It's in the Kitchen Restaurant on Park Street, Dundalk, from 4 o'clock onwards to discuss a campaign strategy mainly focused on making Louth County Hospital to function as an acute hospital. We also will ask interested support group members to become campaign coordinators in their areas in Dundalk South constituency, which includes Drumiskin and Darver. Your help in this effort is appreciated. Another text from Sean, who says, Eamon Ryan is installing cameras on traffic lights in order to catch drivers breaking the red. We all know that cyclists are the worst offenders who just go through the lights. Will the cyclist get the same fine as the motorcyclist? Or is the motorist, or will they be ignored as they're already cycling on the footpath and no penalties are issued? Right, Sean, I think point taken and no argument with it. I don't think the cyclists will be caught in the same way motorists are, because they don't have a reg plate, and I presume it's the reg plate that will identify them. And if it is just the motorists who are identified, I don't think that it's going to be a bad thing necessarily. Yes, it would be very good to clamp down on all the wrongdoings of cyclists, no doubt about that. We can only appeal to them to obey the rules of the road. But there are so many motorists who go through the red light, and you see it. I don't know, if you watch out for it, you'll see it all of the time. The light goes red and a car continues to go, and the car behind it, and quite often the car behind it. Quite often three cars will go through a red light in a row. But perhaps this will bring about an end to it, because the cameras will be on the traffic lights. Indeed, Deirdre and Kel's in touch with us, saying they shouldn't be cutting back on cancer services. Something needs to be done urgently. The health system is a joke, and Simon Harris may do something and fund the service. If not, people could die. And Deirdre reminds us of how she raised over €50,000 for cancer services a few years back. Thank you indeed, as always, for your message. 208-6180-658.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
The terrible conflict, Israeli-Hamas conflict in Hamas now, is really becoming very serious, and there's the very real threat of it becoming a regional war.
Over the weekend, Iran launched a large-scale attack on Israel. Over 350 ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, armed drones and rockets were fired from Iranian soil, as well as Iraq, Yemen and Lebanon, towards the state of Israel. Across the skies of the Middle East, a coalition was activated to counter this attack, marking the start of the IDF's operation Iron Shield. The Israel Defense Forces, together with the United States Central Command, the British and the French Armed Forces, and other partners, operated together in real time in the air, on the ground, and at sea. Defense systems were activated, the threats were intercepted, and Iran's attack on Israel failed. Operation Iron Shield proved the strength of our ironclad cooperation. I want to thank all our international partners who stood up to Iran's aggression. Iran's attack has created new opportunities for cooperation in the Middle East.
Now, this is the Israeli Defense Forces Chief of the General Staff, Lieutenant Herzi Halavi.
We are closely assessing the situation. We remain at our highest level of readiness. Iran will face the consequences for its actions. We will choose our response accordingly. The IDF remains ready to counter any threat from Iran and its terror proxies as we continue our mission to defend the state of Israel.
And that can only mean more bloodshed. Let's speak to Oliver Sears, founder of Holocaust Awareness Ireland. Good morning to you once again, Oliver, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. Obviously, we're looking at the Iranian retaliation to the attack on its consulate in Damascus, which now Israel looks determined to retaliate to. It seems as though this bloodiest of wars is about to get a lot more bloody. I take it, like all of us, you're very concerned about that.
It's deeply concerning, and it's very hard to read. Obviously, the Iranians tipped off the Israelis and their allies, because the Americans claim that they weren't tipped off, but actually they had so many of their own defenses in place to counter this onslaught that you do wonder. I mean, it was not a surprise. I think that Iran is also comprehensively infiltrated by Israeli spies and spies from other countries too. So I think it's very difficult for Iran to pull any kind of surprise attack. Now, as far as this Israeli attack on its consulate, mm-hmm. on the consulate is concerned, it's not clear at all whether it was officially a consulate. The Iranians are saying that it isn't, that it was. The Israelis claim it wasn't. But actually, you know, they did kill someone who was heavily involved in planning the October the 7th attack. So within, one has to understand the parameters and the rules of the Middle East. You know, a lot of, there is a lot of criticism of Israel for behaving in an anti-democratic way as far as the way it wages war. But it's very difficult for it to behave like Denmark or like Ireland when it is surrounded by countries who have a different set of rules. So while obviously I would prefer that rules of engagement militarily are upheld by all parties who engage in war, that's you're in a fantasy land if you think that that will ever apply in the Middle East. How this plays out is hard to know. Netanyahu obviously is kind of a busted flush. Everybody knows that he is most interested in himself and staying in power. There is a cabinet which is, you know, it's the furthest right an Israeli government has been, and then some. And you have in Iran a deeply malevolent, malignant regime, which is holding its own country to ransom. If you know anything about Iranian society, it is incredibly sophisticated. It's incredibly politically astute, and it is held to ransom by, for since 1979, by a theocracy which is corrupt, and basically spends hundreds of millions of dollars on proxies. There are about half a dozen of them in the Middle East, just trying to project power and destabilizing the region in order to be top dog. It's not unlike Russia in that way.
All right. At the same time, I'm sure you wouldn't advocate a war with Iran or a regional conflict because the consequences would be so great. I saw you quoted in the Irish Times yesterday saying that Netanyahu is the worst thing to have happened to the state of Israel since its foundation. Why do you believe that?
Well, look at what he has given Israel. I mean, he basically touted himself as being Mr. Security. Israel is far worse off now than after 16 years. I mean, when he came to power, effectively, he buried any hope of peace with the Palestinians. That was not on his agenda at all. His agenda was to stoke fear. He was a populist in the way that we've come to know them more recently since Trump and co, you know, a decade before. So he stokes fear. And it's easy to stoke fear in among Israelis because there is a genuine fear of being attacked from many fronts. And, you know, look at the cost to Israel's economy. Look at the cost to Israeli society from an external point of view and how it's viewed. For me, it's such a crying shame. This is a country that could have been as stable as any liberal democracy in Europe had it played its cards differently, but it didn't. Its enemies have taken advantage of this kind of trend towards extremism. And any kind of foreseeable peace with its neighbors seemed close a while back. Now it seems very far away.
Yeah, you mentioned the 7th of October and the atrocity carried out by Hamas. But do you believe that the response has been collective punishment?
Well, I think it's fair to say that whether it was intended or not, Palestinians collectively are suffering. I think that you can't simply lay that at Israel's door. I think that the behavior of Hamas has been it's hard to fathom, isn't it, really? They've spent $1 billion on 500 kilometers of tunnels alone, not accessible for the ordinary Gazan, of course. And Hamas simply don't care about the lives of their own. There is no evidence of that whatsoever. Any other regime would have simply negotiated whatever it cost, a ceasefire. Because protecting your own when you're under that kind of onslaught has to be a priority, I would have thought.
Perhaps so, but if Hamas doesn't have regard for its own, as you put it, Oliver, that doesn't make those people dispensable either, does it? And we're talking about nearly 34,000 people who have died as a result of the Israeli onslaught, over 75,000 people wounded.
You've got to be a little bit careful with those figures, because within that 34,000, there are estimated to be 14,000 Hamas fighters. There are people who die ordinarily over a year of ordinary circumstances. No doubt it's very high. No doubt, certainly initially, there was an element of revenge. And, you know, I am on record as saying that I wanted a ceasefire day one. I thought that an incursion into Gaza, the way that Israel has prosecuted this war, is a disaster for everybody. But, you know, Israel is facing in Hamas an organization that wants to destroy it. So one has to see from an Israeli perspective, how on earth are you going to deal with such a regime?
Well, perhaps that's a legitimate question, but I don't believe the answer, which at this stage has included leaving innocent civilians, including children, in situations where there is no escape, where there's no food, there's no water, there's disease, and of course there's always the threat of military offensive of some sort that will extinguish your life. All of that seems terribly, terribly wrong. And last time I spoke to you, Oliver, you rejected the idea of it being a genocide. It's been said many times over since then that people believe this is a genocide, and that apart from the military might of Israel, these other things, such as famine, are being used as weapons of war.
Well, I find all of that shocking. If it really is the case, I think that certainly there is evidence that Israel could certainly have done more, no doubt, done more in terms of bringing aid to the area. I think they are now. I think that, again, no doubt, when a scenario like this breaks out, criminal gangs get involved, and when the food and aid is not distributed properly, there is a black market, and the situation is absolutely appalling. It should never have come to this at all. I do reject the genocide argument. I think that actually, for all sorts of reasons, I don't think that I think it's bad enough without jumping onto a legal term that is impossible to prove. And actually, if you really learn about the origins of the word genocide and where it came from and how it was used after Nuremberg, not during the Nuremberg trials, funnily enough, you find that it's a very problematic term, because in the hierarchy of international crimes, where you have crimes of aggression and you have crimes against humanity, genocide is regarded as the most serious crime. So if you are as a country or a nation, if you are a victim of state-sponsored aggression, you're always going to look for the crime of genocide, because it's the one that carries supposedly the biggest penalty. Although impossible to impose. However, the downside for using genocide is that it creates and stirs up racial tension. And it's interesting, isn't it, that during the Nuremberg trials, genocide, which was a new term, was rejected in favor of crimes against humanity, because crimes against humanity prosecute the individual rather than the state. So it's more likely to have a kind of more precise focus and less of a kind of racial overtone. Of course, that's what part of the reason that it was designed after the Holocaust. But it's very, very difficult for me, given my background as the son of a Holocaust survivor, to look at in genuine horror at what is happening in Gaza and in Israel, and to look at the term genocide and see it being applied. And there is a very sinister reason for that too, which I absolutely recoil from.
Okay. Oliver, good to talk to you. Thank you for joining us this morning. Once again, Oliver Sears, founder of Holocaust Awareness Ireland.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
If you're a member of An Garda Síochána Conor, the emergency services in general, or the defence forces, and you're planning to retire shortly, you may be interested in a career fair that is to take place in the city north on Thursday evening. Let's hear a little bit more about this. Stephen Moore is an ex-Garda and founder of Out of the Blue Training. He joins us now, and a very good morning to you, Stephen, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. You set up Out of the Blue Training last November in order to counsel people in terms, guide them in terms of what careers might be available to them. Tell us a little bit more about what you do.
Hi, yes, good morning, Michael. Thanks for having me on. Yes, I resigned from a Garda Síochána kind of last October, and I suppose I was looking myself for a company or an agency to kind of help and support me kind of making that transition from, I suppose, the public sector into the private sector, a life of service and kind of going beyond that. And I didn't find one in Ireland, and I kind of reached out over to America and over to England where there are such companies. So I suppose I kind of had a skill set here and I had connections here, and I decided, well, I believe that the servicemen and women here in Ireland deserve that help. So I decided to set up the company Out of the Blue.
Mm. Okay. What good options are there in front of people? I suppose becoming a private detective or a security guard are the kind of obvious options, are they?
Yeah, well, like, I wouldn't pigeonhole people, because what I've found is that the members in service, they have a huge number of transferable skills that transfer easily across into the private sector. So I suppose in the past you would think, you know, a guard, somebody in the army, naturally would fall into security or something like that. But what I've learned from the network I've established is that guards or military personnel have gone on to a broad range of jobs in, you know, big companies, you know, multinational companies. They've gone, you know, and raised through the ranks in these companies as well. They've set up their own companies, their own businesses as well. So there is a natural fit with something as what you said, private detective, security, that line. But you actually find out that when you look deeper, that they've gone and they've branched out into all sectors.
Mm. And quite often we're talking about relatively young people.
Well, definitely. Like, if you think you serve 21 years in the army and you join at 17, you're retiring, some people, at 38. So they're very much willing and able, and they have to go on to a second career. And what we're finding, I suppose, with Garda Síochána now, it's different than it was 20, 30 years ago. When you're retired, you're retired. You know, these people have to go on again and look forward into that second career. And that's where the problems kind of start, because I suppose you've been institutionalized, you've worked in one particular sector, and you're only used to that sector. Like for me, Michael, the whole aspect of drawing up a CV after 20 years in the Guards terrified me. I didn't know where to start, because back when I was sending CVs out, you had the one particular CV that you sent to so many companies. Mm. But obviously now, today, it's so different, because you have to, you know, send a particular CV to each job, each role that you're going for, because you need to be relevant to that role and you need to show, you know, the people what value you're adding to the company.
Yeah, and I suppose when a lot of people joined the force, they have remembered the situations vacant column in the papers. If they were looking for a job, it's not the case anymore.
No, it's totally different, you know, and the whole, I suppose, the whole world of networking, it would be alien to kind of people who are, you know, working in the force or in the military. Mm. You know, LinkedIn would be something that's alien to us or to me when I was there. So it was only when I kind of left that my eyes were open and I kind of saw that, well, these people, they do need help. They do need, you know, specific training for that transition, but they also need their own network. So with Out of the Blue, what we want to do is build that network among, you know, ex-guards, ex-military, but kind of show other companies, well, you know, these people are coming out, they have so many transferable skills that you would not imagine, and they're ready to go on to a second career.
Okay.
You know, and we want to say to people, you know, that they're here, they're ready, they're able, they're disciplined, and you know, reach out to kind of companies and kind of go, well, you know, give them a go, let's hire them.
A listener wondering if prison officers would be included in this.
They would. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Prison officers as well. It would be anybody, Michael, really, that falls under, you know, that saying, emergency services.
And are you able to match people looking for a new career with prospective employers?
That is what we're hoping to go to. So with the Expo on Thursday, it's kind of maybe, you know, the first stage. So a lot of people were contacting me and looking for assistance and help. So I kind of said, well, how can I go about doing this under one day, have a one-stop shop for everything? So we invited recruiters, we invited upskilling institutions, we invited, you know, financial advisors, investment opportunities as well to kind of come along. So if somebody comes, I'm hoping there's a stall or there's a speaker that's there, you know, that is going to help and assist them with whatever they're looking for, you know. And with that, I'm you know, moving forward into the summer, I'm going to launch Out of the Blue Recruitment, and that's the next phase, Michael, when we kind of, you know, when I'll reach out personally to a number of companies across the country and kind of explain to them the transferable skills that these people have. Okay. And I'm hoping that, you know, when everything's explained to them, you know, that they'll be ringing me and they'll be looking for kind of candidates that we will have.
Okay, very good. And obviously people will be interested if they wish to attend. It's at 5 o'clock on Thursday in the City North, isn't it?
No, it's not. It's actually, Mike, it's 10 to 5. So
I beg your pardon.
If they show at 5, they might say it's packing up. But
I haven't got my glasses on, Stephen. It's no from problem. 10 in the morning until 5 in the evening at the City North. I beg your pardon.
And Michael, they can find out details and they can purchase tickets through our website, outofthebluetraining.com.
Okay, very good. Thank you indeed for joining us today, Stephen Muir, ex-Garda and founder of Out of the Blue Training. Now, let's take a break.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Time now, as is usually the case around this time on a Tuesday, for our weekly visit to the Garda Crime Desk. As usual, there's a number of incidents Garda are investigating locally. Perhaps you can assist with those investigations. Garda Catherine Patterson joins us for this week's report from Dundalk Garda Station. And good morning to you, and thank you for joining us. We're going to begin with a robbery that occurred in Dundalk. You're reappealing for anybody who may have information about this. This happened a little over 3 weeks ago.
Yes, Michael. So this robbery took place in the Market Street area of Dundalk on March 31st, which would have been Easter Sunday. We're investigating it here in Dundalk and we're seeking the assistance of your listeners. The robbery from a person took place just before 8 p.m. on Sunday the 31st of March, Easter Sunday, at Market Street, as was just mentioned. The male victim was walking alone on Market Street in the town centre when at approximately 20 to 8, he noticed that he was being followed. At one point, the male following him, we believe another male aged in his 20s, grabbed him by the arm and produced a knife. The suspect then demanded money from the victim before running away empty-handed and making his way possibly from Tombrassel Street towards the Tesco Extra at Stapleton Place, through the little car park and onto the Avenue Road. Now, as was said, it took place Easter Sunday. It was still bright as the clocks had changed the night before, and we believe that this crime was conducted by a male acting on his own. So we are appealing to any of your listeners who may have been in the vicinity of the town centre of Dundalk, particularly Market Street, Clanbrassil Street, and anyone who may have come across a male acting suspiciously or perhaps caught this male running away on dash cam footage. If you believe you can help us, please get in touch. The number for Dundalk is 042-938-8400.
Now, you're trying to track down whoever it was who assaulted a man in Drogheda. This was on Saturday night, just gone by. Saturday night, Sunday morning, in the small hours of Sunday morning, outside of a pub on the Cord Road.
Yes, Michael. So Drogheda are investigating this incident, and they're seeking witnesses to the assault, which, as you said, took place in the early hours of Sunday just past at a licensed premises in the Cord area. At approximately 3:30 in the morning, ambulance personnel were dispatched to Cord Street to treat a male who'd been found on the ground just outside a licensed premises with a cut to his left eye. The male victim was treated at the scene before he was removed to Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital for treatment of non-life-threatening injuries. Now, unfortunately, the victim was unable to provide a description of whomever attacked him, but investigating Gardaí are in the process of harvesting CCTV and would like to speak to anyone who may have witnessed the assault taking place or who may have been socialising in the Cord Street area between the hours of 3am and 3:30am in the early hours of Sunday morning and late Saturday night. Maybe this incident or the aftermath of it was captured on your mobile phone or even on your dash cam footage. So if you think you can assist us in any way, please get in touch with Drogheda Garda Station. And the number in Drogheda is 041-987-4200. Or as always, Michael, in the case of any investigation, you can get in touch with the Garda Confidential Line. And the number for that is 1800-666.
Right, a most disturbing story next, which occurred in Dunleer a week ago tomorrow, and a derelict building set on fire.
Yeah, so this incident took place, we're investigating the circumstances of this incident, which took place in the RD Road area of Dunleer, like you've said, last Wednesday, just up on a week, just on a week tomorrow, the 10th of April at 8:20 in the evening. The fire service notified ourselves that they were in the process of extinguishing a blaze at a derelict property in the area and that they were of the belief that the fire had been started maliciously. So investigations are currently at an early stage and a technical examination of the scene was conducted by both the fire service and our divisional scenes of crime unit. At this point, investigators are confident that the blaze was started in a bedroom to the rear of the building and caused extensive damage to the room, which led to the attic collapsing. Detectives investigating the incident are currently calling to homes in the area in a bid to secure CCTV, which may have captured anyone involved. We would like to seek the assistance of the public and request that anyone in the vicinity of the RD Road area of Dunleer between the hours of 6pm and 9pm last Wednesday, the 10th of April, get in touch with us if they believe they came across any suspicious behaviour. Any drivers in the area who at the time may have witnessed something untoward are urged to check their dashcam footage and make it available to the detective unit in Drogheda if they believe they can help. Again, you can pass on your information to Drogheda Garda Station 042-987-4200, the Garda Confidential Line, or indeed any Garda stations that is handy to you.
Okay, well, it's not unusual to hear of valuable tools being stolen on the Garda Crime Desk this week, though we've that story in reverse with some tools that have been recovered that you'd like to return to the rightful owner.
Yes, Michael. So in Dundalk here, we're trying to seek down the owner of a number of tools which were discovered in the grounds of the Redeemer Church in Ardesmond in Dundalk over the weekend. A gardener attending to the area came across this property, which we believe has was discarded quickly, in a quick manner. We believe the tools belong to someone in the building trade, and we do believe they're worth a substantial amount of money. There were two specific brands of items, and all items were transported in hold-all bags, which bore the same branding as the tools themselves. So if you're a tradesman or you know a tradesman who has had their work tools stolen, please get in touch with the property office at Dundalk Garda Station, who will be able to give you further details. Now, the office, the property office, the PEMS office, is open from 9am to 5pm, and you can get in touch with them by ringing 042-938-8400. Obviously, proof of ownership will be required if you believe these tools belong to you. Listeners are also, we would also ask listeners to take a look at our Meads and Louth Garda Facebook pages, as our property officers frequently update the pages with images and details of property which we've found or has been handed in. Some of the items this week that we're seeking to reunite with their owners include a silver wristwatch, which was found in the Frederick Street area of Ashburn on April 15th, a purple ladies bicycle, which was recovered in Trim, a stainless steel medical bracelet found at the retail park in Dundalk on the 5th of April, and a green Wayfarer bicycle, which was retrieved in Mahevna Moor in Dundalk on April the 4th.
Okay, all right. Well, as you say, people can have a look on the Mead and Louth Garda Facebook pages if any of those items sound like something that had been taken unlawfully from them. We're going to conclude, though, with a piece which is for listeners in County Louth only, and all of the good work that's been done in communities across County Louth and how the Gardaí want to recognise that, in particular the good work done by young people in communities across the county and the Gardaí Youth Awards for the county.
Yes, Michael. So yesterday, Inspector Martina Gallagher from our Community Engagement Section in Dundalk was delighted to announce the launch of this year's Louth Gardaí Youth Awards, which are being sponsored by Centra. The Gardaí Youth Awards were launched back in 2019 by Commissioner Drew Harris, and they were launched to celebrate the outstanding young people in our communities aged between 13 and 21. The awards are aimed at recognising good work and positive contributions that young people are making throughout our communities. So the winners of our divisional awards will qualify for the National Youth Awards. They take place in Dublin later on in the year and are presented by Commissioner Harris. The awards include a group award, which is presented to two or more people who have made the community a safer place to live in, an individual award, which is presented to youth who have made a positive contribution to their community by making it a safer place to live, a special achievement award, which is presented to a young person who has had to overcome difficult circumstances, who has defied all the odds and whose commitment deserves special recognition. We also have a Community Safety Award, in which the winner will have implemented or assisted in a crime prevention or safety initiative, and an Outstanding Contribution to Young People Award. This is aimed at an adult mentor or a coach who's provided invaluable help and guidance to young people. So we're currently sending out these nomination forms to our post-primary schools and youth clubs, but if you've somebody in mind that you feel would be a worthy recipient, you can download the forms on www.centra.ie, or you can pick them up from the community policing offices.
Very good.
In Dundalk, okay. RD and Drogheda.
Centra.ie.
Closing date for those is the 7th of May. Michael, okay. Just if anybody's interested.
I'm over time. Have to leave it there. Thank you indeed for joining us this morning. That's Garda Catherine Patterson of Dundalk Garda Station. We'll return to the Garda Crime Desk in around the same time on next Tuesday's programme. That's our programme for today. God willing, we'll see you for our next programme tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. right here on LMFM. Good morning. Bye-bye.
The Michael Reid Show Podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.